Welcome to Michigan Writers on the Air, a program about writers, writing, reading, and listening here in northern Michigan. I'm Aaron Stander. On this edition of Michigan Writers on the Air, Jack Driscoll talks about his stunning new collection of short stories, The Goatfish and the Lover's Knot. Then Sarah Shoemaker reads from her successful new novel, Mr. Rochester, based on Charlotte Bronte's Jane Eyre. At the end, Fleeta Brown provides an audio essay on Michigan poet Robert Fanning. I'm delighted to welcome Jack Driscoll back to Michigan Writers on the Air. Jack is the author of 11 books, including 4 novels, 4 volumes of verse, and 3 collections of short stories. Over the years, his work has garnered an array of literary prizes. Jack's recent collection of short stories, The Goatfish and the Lover's Knot, came out this past spring from Wayne State University Press. Welcome, Jack.
Thank you.
Jack, you started as a poet, and then you wandered off into short stories and novels. How did this all happen?
It's true. I think the first 30 years of my writing life was as a poet, and it wasn't all that long ago when I got introduced at a reading as a poet masquerading as a novelist. So maybe I'm still a poet writing prose.
And your prose often looks like poetry.
Yeah, and I take that as a high compliment. You can do things linguistically in a short story that are unsustainable novel length. And I started as a poet, went to short fiction, went to longer fiction, novels, and then back now to short fiction. And my wife Lois keeps asking me, "Do you think the pendulum will swing all the way back, and you'll end your career by writing poems?" And I was so unequivocal with my answers, no, and no, and now I'm not so sure. We'll see.
Your short story, On This Day You Are All Your Ages, was listed as a distinguished story in 2016 and included in the Best American Short Stories. Could you talk about that story and maybe read from it?
Yeah. First of all, it's the first story I've ever written in second person. I've been avoiding that for a long time. I keep telling my students, you have to keep ranging out. You have to break through to that next place where you haven't been. And you need to try everything at least once. So at least you know what you're arguing against or for. And so I finally got around to doing it. And it's, I was reading the classic William H. Gass's In the Heart of the Heart of the Country, in which he says, "On this day, I am all my ages." And so I appropriated that, went second person, and called this story, On This Day, You Are All Your Ages. It's nonlinear. It's the way I think about time. I think about time as composite or simultaneous, or the term I like best, stereoscopic. Time happening at all times. In other words, the past ticking inside the present, or what Judith Kitchen calls the past and the present in tandem, that they happen simultaneously. If they didn't, probably we'd have no such thing as flashback. And so this doesn't have a conventional through line. It's more a montage or pastiche. If I could do visuals, it would be like poof, 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 poof. It would go in and out of time. So I'll read just a couple of short sections from it to hopefully illustrate that. On this day, you are all your ages, and the longevity genes are on your side. Your mother at 81 still owns that same outdated 2-bedroom, bath and a half, red brick ranch where you grew up, a valid driver's license, and a Buick Skylark that, as she says, was built to last. And your father, former Special Forces, had already lived a dozen lifetimes before he died of unnatural causes. Not a shotgun or a noose or a hose attached to the exhaust pipe, because nowhere in your family history is there any evidence of that. And even you, Marjorie Breitweiser, a casualty of late-stage divorce and addiction to loneliness, will not be the first. Certainly not mid-morning on a Saturday afternoon such as this, clear skies and the forecast going forward calling for temperatures in the upper 60s. If you could, you'd bury the past and live each day as if it were your last. But the truth is, you want her back. That feisty, quirky kid who, in recollection, keeps kissing her own wrist and calls it practice. Remember that? The 11-year-old who harangues against any electric surgery to correct those severely crossed and oversized eyes? It's a fact. Especially when you're tired or upset that they're apt to wander off on their own and almost touch. But why tis out about it is what you'd like to know. After all, your vision is 20/20, and, as you insist, in the end that's all that really matters, isn't it? No floaters, no nightmares or blackouts or seeing double, no dizziness or trances in the world, as far as you can tell, in perfect focus. So what's the big hurry anyway? You're already wearing braces, and how many correctable features can there be in a single face? Besides, there must be, back then and possibly even now, someone out there somewhere determined to love you exactly as you are. Don't hold your breath, your mother says, and that it's no big deal, an upgrade. A routine realignment is all, and you imagine two tiny silvery blue wheels spinning silently behind your closed lids. She reads you the riot act, calls you selfish, belligerent, and naive. She says, I don't need this. Says, snap out of it, Marjorie, before it's too late. Or believe you me, you'll forever live to regret this. And refers to you in moments of frustration as Miss High and Holy, who can't see past your own stubbornness, a first-class drama queen. Could be she's right, but an attitude adjustment you don't need. You like who you are, and when she holds up a hand mirror and says, honest to God, it's her who's rattled and shamefaced, not you. Far from it. And still she offers as evidence before and after photos of women and girls and guarantees 100% that the outcome will turn you gorgeous. Best in show, she jokes, when she's in a better mood, like you're some poodle or shih tzu or Pekingese. Talk about freaks of nature. Maybe, you say, but she says no, not if, when. She says, argument over, now look at me. But your stare downs of late have become so intense that sightlessness might seem a mercy. And then the story is in breaks and sections, and each section finds her at a different time. So when the story starts out, she's 83 years old. But it casts back to when she's 14 and then when she's 50. And it actually ends when she's just about to take her first steps when she's 10 or 11 months old. So that's what I mean when I say nonlinear, or the past, present. The future is simply time not born, and it too will become the present and the past and the deep past. And that's how I think about time. And you're right. It's the it's the thematic element that I hope unifies the collection as a whole. You're not aware of these things. I mean, I was giving an interview just earlier this week, and somebody asked me about obsessions, and I said, well, perhaps a writer goes through a career with a set of with a obsession or a set of obsessions, and clearly my early work was a focus on the relationship between fathers and sons. But this isn't a conscious signature. This comes as a result of the unconscious. And the way I come to know what it is I'm writing about is by reading reviews of my own work. I mean, if I set out to write with this in mind, if this were a conscious ploy, it would stop me dead in my tracks.
I once heard you tell a group of Interlochen students that you build a short story by collecting a couple of characters and getting them in trouble. All the characters in Goatfish and The Lover's Knot seem to be in trouble.
Yeah, well, I'm so anti-happily ever after. I mean, that's the great fallacy of writing. I mean, that doesn't exist. Charlie Baxter has a terrific essay in the Southern Review, and he talks about how much more interesting Adam is after the fall when we see him naked and exposed. And before then, he's non-narratable. There is no story there. He can't even determine what perfection is because he lives that. And it's also why Graham Greene says, what's there to write about happiness? Or Jane Hirschfield says, in happiness, tremble. There is no such thing. And if it were true, well, first of all, if your characters were happy, you'd never hear from them. You only hear from them when they're in trouble. And that's what makes for story.
And place is so important in this collection also. I was thinking about place. Everything's within a gas tank of where we're sitting.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. People of characters who have spent their entire life here but dream constantly about being elsewhere. All 10 of these stories are set in northern Michigan. This is the place I write from. I'm not a northern Michigan writer. I'm an American writer who happens to live in northern Michigan and sets his stories here because this is the landscape I know. And there was a time when place and character were the same thing. For example, the 15th century contemplative St. Teresa of Avila, or my middle namesake, St. Francis of Assisi, Jesus of Nazareth, Sappho of Lesbos, Timon of Athens, Robin of Nottingham. There was no differentiation. And the truth is that character, behavior, character is formed by a place itself, which is why tell me the landscape in which you live, and I will tell you who you are. Especially if you live in an extreme environment like this, where, of course, the standing joke is there are only three seasons in northern Michigan, July, August, and winter, or what the locals refer to, they refer to summer as 2 months of bad sledding, right? I mean, this is where we live, and that has an effect on human behavior. And finally, this, there's an implicit tension created by what the place provides, what the community, the place itself provides, and what it can't possibly give. And that's where desire comes in, which also forms character. That's the need to jump the fence, to jump outward, to go to be somewhere else. And then what Jim Harrison calls that need to get back. That's what creates story, tension and trouble. Why do your characters do this? And what are the consequences? It's all cause and effect.
So the thematic aspect to this book, were these stories that were out there and you pulled them in to fit a theme, or what was the process?
No, that kind of patterning happens without me being conscious of it. So little in storytelling for me, story making for me, is premeditated, but that's process. And you can't be prescriptive about process. People get to the end of their stories in the quirky ways in which they do. But I'm really comfortable in the presence of not knowing. I really, when I sit down to write a story, have no clue where it's going. I just follow hunches and I worry a lot. I'm a sentence by sentence, maybe even a word by word writer. So we've circled back and we're talking again about being a poet. When I was writing poems, if I inscribed a line, a first line that was interesting enough for me to push forward, that was enough, having no idea whatsoever where that poem was going. This is also true of short story writing. It gets a little more complicated than this. If I can't hear the sentence, if it's what I call tin-eared, if there's no music or no drama to the language itself, Henry James told us, dramatize, dramatize. And the way in which I do that most often, at least as I'm composing, is to listen to what that sentence feels like. David Roderick says this, it's not the tale that pleases, it's the telling, it's the delivery, what Mary Carr calls the delivery system, what David Long calls the brain of the story. In other words, the voice. That propels the story forward. That, as much as anything, is the way in which I proceed.
So do you read aloud as you are writing?
Yeah, and I find it difficult to go on to next. Every next sentence, a sentence is a unit in which words occur, and they can either be cared about or they can be sloppily presented. And there are what we call bangers, those people who don't care about this. They would just want to get through a first draft as quickly as they can, and then they come back and think about it, but that's not the way I work. I can't work that way. Because I don't know where I'm headed in the story, I don't know how the action or the plot is going to coalesce. I believe that every next sentence, what I write in one sentence makes possible what's going to happen in the next sentence, and the next sentence, and each sentence will take me farther into the story, and eventually that story will start talking back to me. I will see patterns form. But in the early going, I have no idea where this is headed.
So as a teacher, you're forced to think about this process as you talk to students, and you've worked for many years with Arts Academy students, and now you work with graduate students. Questions like point of view, first person, second person, right. third person, you've had to think about it in sort of a meta way to be able to articulate it to students. Could you talk about that? Like, I was surprised when I hit the second person story in the collection.
Yeah, I was too. And I love that. I don't know how many times, thousands of times, have quoted Frost's edict. No surprise for the writer, no surprise for the reader. And I trust that implicitly. And if I'm not surprising myself by as I said earlier, moving into that next place where I haven't yet arrived, then I'm in danger of self-imitation. And that's the last thing I want, to write a story that becomes comfortable for me. I want to write the new story, and I want to believe that that next story is going to be the best story I've ever written, or there's no reason to even begin with it. So it almost insists that I keep breaking new ground. And all these fictional elements come up. They're in the toolbox, or what I call the repair kit, and point of view is one of them. And it may be the single most important decision that the writer makes. Whose story is this to tell? Who's best equipped to tell this story? From where are they standing and seeing this story or the world of this story? Who has the most to lose? Who is going to be changed most dramatically by it? So it's a huge decision. But there's not a tremendous difference between first-person storytelling, except that it's told by a character, and close third, which, of course, is told by the writer. But they're close and so similar that sometimes I find them indistinguishable. But first-person stories oftentimes are voicey. You know, it's all about, part of the appeal of the story is the delivery itself. It's not what the words mean, but how you feel when you hear them. Thus, you have Holden Caulfield. Mm-hmm. And try imagining that in second person or third person. And then you think, yeah, but how about George Saunders, The End of Firpo in the World? It sounds so first person that I actually had to go back the other day to check and prove myself wrong that it was third person. So there are, you know, there's similarities. There's, the argument is there's more distance. The writer is afforded more distance in a third person story. But there's so many overlaps and variations, a kind of mutation that occurs that sometimes makes the delivery sound a lot alike.
So your teaching is not prescriptive. You invite people to. Yeah, no. Make a mess and then figure it out.
Yeah, and they should be making a mess. They should be receptive to everything that's coming at them in the early drafts. To get too fussy too early is to, one metaphor might be if you're wiping down the counters, sanitizing the counters, you have a tendency to forget that people live in that house. You know, it's too clean, too sanitary. No, I want them to be open, to be receptive to everything that's coming at them. And that's where revision comes in. And that's why William Matthews says, revision isn't cleaning up after the party. Revision is the party. You know, that's where the real writing comes in. If we were known by our first drafts, there'd be no such thing as literature. Nobody would want their name on such things. Stories sometimes are so transformed that they're unrecognizable from what those early drafts looked to be. And I think of early drafts, and I'll tell this to my students as well. Don't even think of them in drafts. Think of them as warm-up. Think of them as taking notes. None of this stuff is going to happen on a first sitting. The story is going to make its own demands, and these early incarnations are going to be so radically changed that you'll wonder how you made the story. And if you went back to try and recreate how that happened, you couldn't do it. That would be a literal impossibility.
You have produced a lot of work over a lot of years, but it's because you work every day.
I work hard, yeah, and that's another rule. There are no rules. I can't remember, who was it, Somerset Maugham, I think, maybe said, there are only three rules for writing. Unfortunately, nobody knows what they are.
Right? Yes. Perfect.
And you know, that's pretty much. No, I don't want. I'm not asked. I don't want students to write like me. I want the students to discover, in the process of number one, writing, and reading. Writing because this is their calling. They tell me, and it's Frost again who says, writing isn't a profession. Writing is a condition. And if you have it, you have it. And if you don't, you don't. If you're not fanatically driven to do this, you're going to wash out at some point. It's the people who can't not do it and who are still standing after everybody else has stepped aside are the ones who are likely to do well.
That's sort of surprising. And I know we've both seen that with students. The people who have the work orientation are the ones who ultimately flourish.
Yeah. The number one rule for me, for somebody who has no rules, number one for me is, yes, stay in the chair, stay in the office, make no excuses. Do not try and divine a strategy by which the process will can ever become earlier, because you will fail it only in about 1,000 different ways. And I tell them this, that talent, which is doled out unequally, it seems, talent must discover its equivalent in a hardcore work ethic. And it's the second half of that equation that is the way more important part. It's hard, hard work. It's really the hardest thing I've ever done. And I learned this from my father, who worked 364 days a year. And I said to him, well, I didn't say to him, I said to myself, I looked at his life, 364 days a year, 16 hours a day. He graduated high school, but not college, and didn't exactly know what college even was, except he believed that he could leverage a better place for his children in the world with a college degree. And I came to learn this as a writer. I said, I'll never do that. I'll never work that many hours. But I worked that kind of hours just in a different venue. He sold beer. He had a bar in Holyoke, Massachusetts, and rumor has it that on St. Patrick's Day, he sold enough green beer to fill the public swimming pool. And although I denied that, you know, when you're young, you're apt to believe that you know how you're going to be thinking or feeling at some future point. And so you make these outrageous claims, I'll never do that, I'll never do that. Well, here I am, working 16 hours a day, but alone in my little cell in a quiet place.
And the next book, poem, or short story will be?
I'm pretty certain that that time in my career has arrived whereby I can actually get away with a new and selected short story collection, which will make it a little easier on me instead of writing in my first short story collection, wanting only to be heard. I think there were 17 stories, but a number of them are much shorter. That's when I had stepped away from the poetry, and the early stories were much shorter than my comfort length now is about 20, 22 pages. They tend to be longer stories. And then The World a Few Minutes Ago, and so there are over 40 published stories now. So I think if I write four or five toward a new and selected, or what I like to call my new and used, that'll be the next book that comes out.
Well, we look forward to that. Now, Jack, this is always a point in the interview where I say, could you tell us about your website and where listeners can find you? And I don't think I can use that question.
It doesn't apply.
Jack Driscoll hiding somewhere in the woods.
Yeah. I'm a technophobe. It scares the daylights out of me. And I was at dinner and people were laughing. They brought this up. They said, you know, you have a presence, but you have no website. You don't have this, that. And I said, no. And they said, we couldn't even access your telephone number. And I thought, yeah, well, if you have no aptitude for this and even less interest, that's a bad combination. So, I should be an arm of the sales force. Every writer needs to be out there disseminating information, publicity, et cetera. I hide away. I just don't do it. I hope other people do it for me. You know, that's where I rely on my friends. Jack's got a new book out. Take a look.
Yes, and they do that. Jack, it's always a pleasure. I hope to see you again in a year or two for the new collection.
Yeah, hope so. Whenever. Thank you again for having me. So always a pleasure here too.
You're listening to Michigan Writers on the Air on Interlochen Public Radio. I'm pleased to welcome Sarah Shoemaker to Michigan Writers on the Air. Welcome, Sarah.
I'm pleased to be here.
And today we're going to be talking about Sarah's splendid new novel, Mr. Rochester. But before we begin to talk about the book, would you provide our listeners with some background about your writing career?
I did write for a long time before I ever got published. Then I published three novels 25 to 30 years ago under a pseudonym, and they were a totally different genre. We retired and moved up here, and I got involved in other things. And then I got the idea for Mr. Rochester.
And that's a story in itself. How did that get started?
Well, I belong to a book group at my local library, which is Leelanau Township Library in Northport. And every year we discuss one classic. And in 2012, we discussed Jane Eyre. Now, when especially women get to talking about Jane Eyre, they usually wind up, or eventually, get to Mr. Rochester, the man she fell in love with, and eventually, by the end of the book, married. And what they're asking is, what is with Mr. Rochester? He seems so mean sometimes. Other times he seems almost pleasant. He seems to favor Jane, but on the other hand, he seems to be romancing Miss Ingram. And then it turns out that he has a wife already who is insane and lives in an upstairs, secluded in an upstairs room. So what are we supposed to make of him? And what did Charlotte Bronte intend for us to think of him? Well, various women have various opinions about that. Some love him, some hate him, some don't get him. So as we were discussing that, I was thinking, what is he like? What does Charlotte Bronte want us to think? And then I was thinking, someone ought to write his story so we could understand it. And then I was thinking, in fact, I blurted out loud, I ought to write his story. I think I'm going to write his story. And by the time I got home from that meeting, I had decided I was going to write that story. And basically I did. And incidentally, this spring, just as Mr. Rochester was about to be published, I came across a quote from Toni Morrison. If there is a book, she wrote, that you would really like to read, but it hasn't been written yet, then you must write it.
How long did it take you to do the research before you could get started with the writing, and how long did the writing take?
Well, I tend to research as I'm writing, sort of ahead of where I am. And it really surprised me when I got finished and looked back on the whole process. It took me just over 2 years, about 2 years and 3 months.
Jane Eyre was published 170 years ago. It's a book about time and place in Victorian England. And your book, Mr. Rochester, covers the same period. Could you talk a little bit about England in the 1840s? It's a fascinating period, a period of great change. And could you talk about the role of women at that time, which this book certainly is about?
Yes, and it's important, actually, to the book. It was, as you say, a time of great change. It was the Industrial Revolution going on then. So people were being put out of their jobs. Weavers, for example, because England had a huge fabric industry, woolen mills mostly, but also cotton mills. They imported cotton from the United States. The machines in the mills displaced a huge number of people, weavers and fullers. And if those names sound familiar to you, that's because that was the occupation of so many people. And they were many of them, most of them displaced, and they went, they had nothing else to do because that was their skill. And then on top of that, it was a little before that was a time when a set of bills were passed in Parliament called the Enclosure Laws, which allowed landowners who owned huge tracts of lands. I mean, there might have been two or three towns or villages within their tract of land, were allowed to take the common land that the common people used to graze their animals. They were allowed by Parliament to fence off those lands and use them and make them unavailable for the common people who were using them. So that, in essence, put an awful lot of other people out of work, and those people were crowded into the cities, and we end up with a system that we see in Charles Dickens, where you have terribly poor people living in terrible conditions in the cities there because they are hoping to get some kind of work because there's no work in the countryside. Now, about the women, women had no power, really no power. They never inherited inheritance. If there was anything owned in the family, it went to the oldest son. And the younger sons hopefully had enough education to get some kind of work like lawyer or doctor or vicar or something like that. Or they went into what's called into a trade, which means they became merchants, and those people were really looked down upon. Women were not allowed to have any of those kinds of jobs. That just wasn't done. So basically, women were under the care of the man who was responsible for them, either their father or their husband or their brother or maybe some other relative. But a woman of class never worked. If she was destitute and if she had an education, she could become a governess. So Jane, in Jane Eyre, is a governess because she had, her parents died and there was no inheritance, which she wouldn't have gotten anyway. But she did have something of an education, so she could become a governess. So a governess is like a step up from being a servant. And at the same time, when she meets Mr. Rochester, because this becomes important, really important in their courtship, he being landed gentry is a step down from royalty. So there's a big social gap between those two. And that social gap was almost never crossed between a man and a woman.
So also in your book, you talk about life in Jamaica at the same time, mm-hmm. which is a very important part of the story. You look at the institution of slavery and the class structure there. How did you research that?
Well, I was really fortunate. We in Michigan have something called the Michigan Electronic Library, which has a catalog, and it's called shorthand MELCAT. MEL for Michigan Electronic Library. And it's basically a catalog of virtually all the public college and university libraries in the state. So I got, in my research, I got more than 50 books from the Michigan Electronic Library. And when I was looking for Jamaica, information on Jamaica in that time period, I went on the Michigan Electronic Library catalog, and I requested something like Jamaican sugar plantations, 19th century, maybe was the subject heading. I don't remember exactly. And they came up with a book titled Marley, the story of a sugar plant, of a sugar plantation. And I couldn't believe that I was going to be able to get a book that was going to tell me everything I need to know. And when it came, it did exactly that. It was a book that was written in the 1830s anonymously but whoever they is in this case, they consider it to be probably autobiographical. And it tells about a young man going from the United Kingdom to Jamaica with not knowing anyone and with no connections, but wanting to somehow get back in his hands the sugar plantation that was owned by his grandfather. And in the process of his arriving and his finding work as the lowest possible white man's work on a plantation and then working up eventually to become a plantation manager, the author tells in that book everything I needed to know about how plantations were organized, about the class structure on plantations, about what everybody's job was, about how the plantation was operated and when they planted and when they harvested, and the whole works in that one book.
Many modern readers struggle with Jane Eyre. Some of the language is unfamiliar, the structure of the novels quite different from modern novels, and there are references to political and historical events we just don't have the context for. For example, in my copy of Jane Eyre, there are 50 pages of notes to help readers. But I found Mr. Rochester very accessible. How did you approach that?
Well, the first thing I did after buying my own copy and reading through it again and marking it all up, as I mentioned, I read probably half a dozen other novels written in the same time period. And of course we look on them now as historical novels, but when they were written, they were contemporary novels. And I was looking for exactly that to some extent, for the kind of language that they use, the rhythms of the language, and also just whatever the book would tell me about what life was like in those days. And if I didn't understand something, I looked it up. And I looked up a lot of things about and got books on a lot of things like marriage in the 19th century England and the labor situation and what it was like for people to live then and what kind of money they made. What the poorest person made and what some of the richest people made, so that I had just a sense of what their life was like.
What was the hardest part of this book to write?
Well, the woman that Mr. Rochester is married to, for those who might be listening that might never have read Jane Eyre, is insane. And it's apparently a familial thing because her mother is also insane and in an institution. That we get from Jane Eyre. I didn't make that up. Rochester goes to Jamaica and his father tells him there's this lovely young woman who's the daughter of a friend of his, and he sort of encourages Edward Rochester to think about her in terms of marriage. And he tells us in Jane Eyre that he never was alone with this young woman. And she was almost inaccessible except at parties when it was a social event. So he really didn't know her very well when they got married, which was not unusual, actually, in those days. Those marriages were often marriages of, we'll say, convenience. A family that has a daughter that they want her to have a good marriage with a man who had some financial backing, and the man wanted to have a wife that was of the right social class. So that's oftentimes how people got married in those days. So he didn't really know her very well, but even I assumed when in my writing that it wasn't obvious at the time that she was insane, that developed. So anyway, my hardest problem was to show that development so that the reader would understand me, maybe even more before Rochester understands that there is something wrong with her mind. And And I consulted with a friend of mine who is clinical psychologist about how that might play out, how it might look. And she helped me some, but I wasn't really convinced it was enough. So I sort of worked out in my own mind. Now I have to take a little side story. In those days, if a woman was inconvenient to the man who was in charge of her life, if she was too independent, he thought, or if he thought she was drank too much, or if he thought she was too interested in sex, or if she acted oddly, or if there was any reason that he found her too inconvenient to have in his care, he would put her in a mental institution. That was not unusual. So I had to be very careful to portray Bertha as genuinely insane, not just inconvenient to Mr. Rochester, so that's why he puts her away. And I just sort of worked it out in my head what would make her seem to be clearly mentally disturbed. And I think I was pretty successful because a woman whom I met who had read my book and who was a psychoanalyst said that she immediately recognized Bertha for what she was.
So would you like to read from Mr. Rochester?
I would be delighted. But, you know, I would sort of like to read from the similar scene, the coordinating scene in Charlotte Bronte's Jane Eyre, so that you get an idea of how I might have taken the story and put my own hand in it, but also put Mr. Rochester at the center of the story instead of Jane. So here's from Jane Eyre. Jane has only recently come to the mansion that he owns to take care of a ward, a young girl, that Mr. Rochester is in charge of. And he has only recently appeared as well. So they don't know each other very well. But he has already insisted that she spend the evenings with him after dinner. Mr. Rochester, as he sat in his damask-covered chair, looked different to what I had seen him look before. Not quite so stern, much less gloomy. There was a smile on his lips, and his eyes sparkled, whether with wine or not, I am not sure, but I think very probable. He was, in short, in his after-dinner mood, more expanded and genial, and also more self-indulgent than the frigid and rigid temper of the morning. Still, he looked preciously grim, cushioning his massive head against the swelling back of his chair, and receiving the light of the fire on his granite-hewn features, and in his dark, great dark eyes, for he had great dark eyes, and very fine eyes, too, not without a certain change in their depth sometimes, which, if it was not softness, reminded you, at least, of that feeling. He had been looking 2 minutes at the fire, and I had been looking the same length of time at him, when, turning suddenly, he caught my gaze, fastened on his physiognomy. "You examine me, Miss Eyre," said he. "Do you think me handsome?" I should, if I had deliberated, have replied to this question by something conventionally vague and polite, but the answer somehow slipped from my tongue before I was aware. "No, sir." "Ah, by my word, there is something singular about you," said he. "You have the air of a little nonnette, quaint, quiet, grave, and simple, as you sit with your hands before you, and your eyes generally bent on the carpet, except, by the by, when they are directed piercingly to my face, as just now, for instance. And when one asks you a question or makes a remark to which you are obliged to reply, you rap out a round rejoinder which, if not blunt, is at least brusque. What do you mean by it?" "Sir, I was too plain. I beg your pardon. I ought to have replied that it was not easy to give an impromptu answer to a question about appearances, that tastes differ, that beauty is of little consequence, or something of the sort." So now I'm reading from my own book and showing how I've written that scene, but from his viewpoint. "Is Miss Eyre there?" I asked, and then I saw her tucked in a corner, as was her way. "Well, come forward. Be seated here." I pulled up a chair closer to my own, for I had no intention of being distracted by Adele. It seemed the sort of moment I had enjoyed far too seldom in my life, a moment of relaxation with the opportunity for true conversation of real depth with a worthy, or so I hoped, conversationalist. But I could not think what to say. For a time there was only the sound of Adele's chatter and the rain driving against the window pane and the crackle and hiss of the fire. I grew aware of Miss Eyre's eyes upon me, as so often I had observed her when she was otherwise occupied. I wondered what she saw there, since I could not remember when I had felt myself truly seen and contemplated in such a way. "You examine me, Miss Eyre. Do you think me handsome?" I asked her. Perhaps I was craving more simple praise, as I had earlier received from my dinner guests, but in that case it was a question foolishly set forth, for her response seemed to surprise us both. "No, sir." There is no gracious recovery from such a response, but her honesty startled me, so different from the craven flattery I'd too often heard since I joined society. So I challenged her to announce what specific faults she found in me. It was not so much that I wanted to hear my failings recited, as it was simple curiosity to know how I looked to those lovely eyes. In all, I could not remember the last time I had spoken to so frankly.
So, Sarah Shoemaker reading from Mr. Rochester. Thank you, Sarah. Are you going to do another book in this genre? What's next?
No, I am not. I thought when I started this, it's easy. All I have to do is tell the Jane Eyre story from his viewpoint and tell readers what he's thinking. But of course, in the first place, he's 35 or 36 when they first meet. So there's 35 or 36 years I had to account for before he even gets to Jane Eyre. And then I hadn't really realized how much there is in Jane Eyre that Mr. Rochester reveals about himself and his background. And when I came to that realization, I realized it was much harder to fit what I wanted to do with his story into what he's told us in Jane Eyre.
If listeners want to find out more information about you or your writing, where should they look?
Well, I have a website. It's Sarah Shoemaker, spelled SarahShoemaker.net. I also have a Facebook page, which is Sarah Shoemaker Author. That is more current. I keep more current information on that than is on the website.
The book again is Mr. Rochester. Sarah Shoemaker, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed it.
Fleta Brown is here. Good morning, Fleta.
Good morning, Aaron. I would like to talk today about a poet, a Michigan poet. He's one of my real finds. His name is Robert Fanning, and he teaches at Central Michigan University. He runs the Wellspring Poetry Series in Mount Pleasant. The collection of poems I want to talk about is new this year. It's called Our Sudden Museum from Salmon Poetry Press in Ireland. On the cover is a farmhouse at night, all the windows lit up. The life of memory, of family, when taken one moment at a time through the eyes of this poet, becomes suddenly a museum. Although in one poem, which I'll read you in a minute, that title appears more specifically. Robert Fanning writes about his daughter, his son, the death of a sister, the suicide of a brother, the death of a father. In fact, you feel the entire deep history of a family in the poems. They're about the knotty risks of living, the risk of a cardiac event, the risk of love itself, even the risk of having your child fall in love with a ladybug that dies. Yeah, don't get the idea that the poems will weigh you down. They're full of grace, intelligence, and humor. They're also about light and blossoms and buying houses. Here's the poem I mentioned. The speaker staying in the house his sister, who's just died, lived in. It's a good example of how sheer grief doesn't take over these poems, how they rise and flourish through it. It's called Staying the Night. I want to touch everything she touched yesterday, my fingers lingering on her shelves and counter. I flip through the paperback left half read on the nightstand, inhale the crumpled yellow hand towel near her bathroom sink, breathe in the dust and dander of her apartment air. My wife sifts a pile of unpaid bills, lifts a framed photo, reads an inscription on a birthday card. This home's a sudden museum. From the living room, I hear our daughter knock a glass thing over and giggle. I move to save the breakables from wreckage, then remember nothing can now be ruined. We're the guests of someone gone. From a stack of papers, I pull some brief note she wrote, marvel at her slight, precise lettering. On her fridge shelf, a tub of leftover spaghetti, an unfinished sandwich. In a drawer, the perishables sweat, a new head of lettuce, a few pieces of fresh fruit. I choose to eat the peach she chose from the grocery's produce rows, not knowing it would outlive her. Later, before going to sleep in her bed, I see a still life next to the kitchen sink, one white bowl upside down, one fork, one knife, and beside the faucet, her unwashed drinking glass. Lifting the glass, I hope to see her lipstick's usual pink wedge, scour for a fingerprint, some smudge. I fill it half full with water, cover the rim with my lips, turn it in a circle slowly. This is how I kiss my sister goodbye. The specifics in that poem just are so sharp, and it's really kind of the specifics that save the speaker, that save us in that poem. There's a gentle but decided humor in Robert Fanning's poems. Here's one that picks up after the end of the world that's been predicted doesn't happen. We're at a donut shop. One phrase some people might not know is tabula rasa, which means literally a tablet wiped clean. The end apparently isn't near is the title of the poem. Hours after the world's prophesied end, a doomsayer sits in the fluorescent glow of a donut shop, dazed before a chocolate glazed with rainbow sprinkles. Along with throngs of others who left their lives behind, sure the end was nigh, who'd huddled and held hands at midnight in parks and churches. He'd knelt bedside as if blindfolded, waiting for the shot to rend the whole day gone, and heard nothing. After the clock's last tick, crickets, his curtain a white flag riffling. Through the window, rain's faint scent, eyes clenched for the end. He lifted his eyes to see a world that shouldn't be. Later, the impossible morning's first birds. For 5 hours he listened, hoping for a mistimed roulette blow until that slit of light. Sunrise, the brutal fact of another day. The cliff's edge, an apparent bluff, the trick candles relit. The noose knot slipped loose. So what would you do, your day a tabula rasa, your life now least and maybe wholly, every second again, a gift unopened? You'd be here too, gnawing on this fat circle, its sprinkles like tipped stars sucked into an event horizon, a hole within a hole, always as it was, but somehow more so. Sweetened. See what I mean about the wonderful wry humor and the skill? You're in the hands of a poet who moves his story step by step, but it's always a bit of a surprise. The poems in this book are the product of a broad and deep mind that uses its considerable intelligence to enrich the moment of the poem, like the one I just read you, with its event horizon, and another about the history of the Catholic concept of limbo. And remember the ladybug, friend? The title of that one is A Consideration of Potential Afterlives and the Ontological Interrelations of All Beings at Bedtime, or The Ladybug Friend. There's another titled Buddhist Temple Ravaged by Ants. I'm not going to read that one as much as you might like me to. I want to end with a poem that gives you a sense of the sonic range of Robert Fanning's work. This poem is good on so many levels, but primarily it speaks to our ears. It's near the end of the book and carries echoes of the losses and sadness of some of the earlier poems, and a wish that the children be kept safe. It's called In a House Swept Away by the Sea. In the boat of the bed, in the boat of the body, in the hold of my child as we sink into sleep, in us both a sea and a sea outside us, outside this house, beside the body of the sea, in the boat of us, in a house, in the night of the body, we float. In the pitch of us, the bedlam and hum, in the rush of wind and sea, in the hush of the child we hold in a house by the sea. One low groan, the moorings moan, and I fear our house will sink. A draft of fear in the heart of the house, a drift of farther fear in the heart of the boat, in the ribs of the hull, the whole of a swallowing sea. In the far and falling, the failing to see, in the fear the heart will fill, in the hope the bones of the house will hold, in the drift of us unmoored and free, in the sea of the blood, in the sea of the body, in the fear will nightly fall, in the real of a dream, in the seeming and real, in a house swept away by the sea. That poem rocks line by line with the motion of the sea. Robert Fanning's poems are always tight against the earth. They look at things we all care about. They aren't afraid of deep grief, and they aren't afraid to laugh. The late poet Thomas Luck said of Fanning's work, "His poems are full-throated, his heart is large enough to drive a truck through. His imagination has and needs no breaks, and he has learned his trade. This is a brilliant book." I agree. The poet is Robert Fanning. The book is Our Sudden Museum, out this year from Salmon Poetry Press in Ireland.
Thank you, Fleta. Thank you for listening to Michigan Writers on the Air. My thanks to Jack Driscoll, Sarah Shoemaker, and Fleta Brown. Also kudos to Daniel Wanshua for his skillful engineering and production work on this show. This program is a production of Interlochen Public Radio. Be sure to listen next time to Michigan Writers on the Air on IPR News Radio. Until then, this is Aaron Stander wishing you great writing, great reading, and the best of all words.